Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment, health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, for years the state has owned hundreds of acres on the San Joaquin River near Fresno, but providing access and paying for maintenance have been a big hurdle in efforts to open the land to the public. Now a Sacramento lawmaker may have a solution, the state park system. We'll talk with the Fresno Bee's Marek Warzowski. We'll also find out why the plaintiffs, who recently won a voting rights lawsuit against Kern County, want the new district boundaries to take place before the next election. That and a look at local works designed by famed architect Julia Morgan. She was the genius behind Hearst Castle, but you can find her works right here in Fresno as well. Those stories coming up later in our program. We begin the show, though, looking at some big changes on the horizon in Merced County. In 2008, the city of Merced was California's ground zero for the housing crisis. Just a few years before that, the University of California's brand new Merced campus opened outside the city, which arguably drove the overdevelopment that set up the city to fall so hard during the recession. Now, 10 years later, UC Merced has invested in the city with a new downtown building. But as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, an even bigger development is already underway that could bring big dividends for the whole community.
Driving toward the university in eastern Merced County, your first glimpse of campus is likely to be construction cranes towering over rolling hills and grazing cattle. Then it's half-constructed buildings, some wrapped in plastic. Finally, you see the giant hole in the ground with the beginnings of a foundation. Campus spokesman Richard Cummings says it's all part of a project called Merced 2020.
Well, we're about to basically see the largest higher education expansion of its type anywhere in North America. We're building 13 buildings simultaneously.
That includes a dining hall, sports facilities, dorms, labs, and classrooms. By the time it's finished in fall 2020, the school will have the capacity to expand from around 8,000 students to 10,000. Its footprint will double to 219 acres. It'll have so many new spaces that not all of them have been claimed.
That's the great thing about this project is that we're building, we're adding on to our house, so to speak, and now we're trying to decide what rooms different kids are going to be living in.
But Merced 2020 isn't all about space. It's about identity and opportunity, expanding the only UC school in the San Joaquin Valley and underscoring its role as a research institution. University Chancellor Dorothy Leland is particularly excited about more laboratory space.
We're going to have a new greenhouse, and we're going to be putting in a very special lab that will allow us to do research on disease-causing organisms. We're also going to have a computational center.
Accessibility is important, too. Leland says the university developed a financing plan for the project that wouldn't raise tuition rates and so wouldn't scare away the very students it's trying to serve.
I think we'll have primarily low-income, first-generation, and underrepresented groups, and that's really the demographic future of California.
On campus, students are excited about future opportunities. Salma Maiman is a UC Merced senior and president of the Undergraduate Students Association.
The swimming pool is a huge one that I know everyone keeps talking about. The rec center is going to be growing. All of our academic buildings that are coming online will offer more classes. That also opens up the conversation to which new majors the school can offer, as well as minors.
The university is also growing into its home in the San Joaquin Valley. Although not a part of Merced 2020, a new downtown administrative center is moving hundreds of jobs into the city of Merced. And even though campus is still 7 miles away, Mayor Mike Murphy says Merced 2020's $1.3 billion investment there is a big deal for the entire area.
To put that in perspective, the City of Merced's general fund, you know, the fund that we have the most discretion over, is about $42 million a year. So their investment is our entire general fund times 30 years.
Murphy says that investment has already led to pressure on the city's housing market.
And so we know that by 2020, we have to have some additional supply of apartments, 1,000 units, just to sort of keep status quo.
It's a tall order and a bit ironic, given what happened 10 years ago. Terry Rusco witnessed the housing crash in Merced from his position as owner of Merced Yosemite Realty.
There was a lot of speculation happening in the housing market. A lot of people were exuberant about the new UC being here. So we kind of were, unfortunately, the poster child of devaluation in property.
But Rusco says renewed development now is a good thing. And excitement about UC Merced is helping the city look toward the future again.
We sat there in the doldrums for, you know, what, 7 years. And then in 2012, when the UC decided on its 2020 project and it started moving forward, it really made a significant difference.
The Merced 2020 project is slated to be finished by the time students arrive on campus in the fall of 2020. As for what comes next, Chancellor Leland says she hopes planning can begin on a new management school. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We all know what a port looks like. There's water and cranes and ships stacked high with shipping containers. But those are often in busy areas on the coast, Los Angeles, Long Beach, and Oakland. Well, one Central Valley county has decided to get in on the shipping and distribution game. Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui reports how that county is partnering with the Port of Los Angeles to give the region a boost for distributing goods around the world.
Just outside the city of Merced, slightly east of Highway 99, is what used to be Castle Air Force Base. Mark Hendrickson is the Director of Community and Economic Development for the County of Merced, and he's giving me a tour.
Right around 1 o'clock, you'll see a very large hangar over there to your right. And that's a
Today, two-thirds of the nearly 2,000-acre base is still an airfield, but the rest of it is now the Castle Commerce Center.
This is a site that has roughly about 75 tenants, about 100 different leaseholds. We generate about $2.9 million in lease revenue.
Like most areas of the valley, it's rural. Across the road from the center are train tracks, and you can hear the railroad crossing signals ding. Hendrickson says this unincorporated area of Merced County is going to become an inland port. Now, there isn't any water around. We're still in the Central Valley. It won't be the kind of port that serves ships and boats. It will be a place for products to be built and materials consolidated and then sent to the Port of Los Angeles.
Our goal and our intention with the redevelopment of Castle is to really turn it into a site where we can focus some solid attention on manufacturing. We want to be a place where things are made, because when things are made, people are working.
Back in October, Merced County's Board of Supervisors developed an agreement with the Port of LA, formalizing what Hendrickson calls a hub and spokes development. Merced will become a place of manufacturing and distribution and use the nearby rail line and freeways to bring goods to LA to then be shipped around the world. In kind, Castle may also become a place where the port can send products for distribution. Merced County isn't the only Valley County building ties with the Port of LA. Kern County recently got approval to expand their foreign trade zone at Tejon Ranch. They also will move the zone's affiliation to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection at the Port of LA. The expansion means all of the industrial areas of Tejon Ranch are now within their foreign trade zone. Companies operating there will get a break on import duties and fees. Tejon Ranch has announced the expansion will bring jobs to Kern County. Hendrickson says the same could happen in Merced when it comes to job creation.
You know, using today's workforce numbers, about one out of every nine jobs would be right here at Castle in about 20 years.
There is one drawback, though. More shipping could mean more air pollution. Dean Flores is a member of the California Air Resources Board and a former state senator from Kern County.
The kinds of jobs and economic growth this brings are very large diesel trucks that are running a lot of things that make the air a lot worse. You know, that balance is really important between jobs, growth, and air mitigation.
One issue is that companies send their trucks full of goods to a port, and then the truck typically returns to the distribution center empty. If that truck is coming to Merced's inland port, that could mean hundreds of miles driven just to return the truck.
Companies need to figure out how to send items to, you know, wherever they're going, but that these cargo trucks not come back empty.
Flores says the Air Resources Board should come up with ways to incentivize companies to share their trucks and reduce the total number on the road. He also says this is really an opportunity for outside groups to develop something like an Uber for trucks, where they share cargo going to the port and returning to the valley.
I doubt if it will be state government that comes up with that, but I do think it will be some outside force that will come in and say, you know, this is the way really trucks should be running in California. We have the sharing mechanism, and it actually can work very, very well.
Flores says he plans to bring this up with CARB later this year. In Merced County, Hendrickson says they plan to use trains to mitigate truck pollution.
We see our using our rail connectivity on site to get trucks off the road, improve air quality, open up shipping opportunities for folks not only through in Merced County, but really throughout the entire San Joaquin Valley to places all over the world.
Finding the best shipping practices from an inland port will take time, and developing an inland port in the first place has been a long time coming. Mike Dozier is the former Community and Economic Development Director for the City of Clovis. He says that these sorts of deals don't just happen overnight.
What happens when you have this vision, and it might be 10 years before that vision starts to materialize?
Dozier says it takes time for infrastructure to develop and to convince groups to believe in the project's potential.
You know, you just build on it. You just have to have things ready for when the time is right.
For Merced County, officials hope that time is now. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in Atwater.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last month, Kern County lost a major court suit to the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. The group had sued the county over its approval for supervisorial district lines that they say disenfranchise Latino voters. Currently, the county only has one Latino majority district, District 5, which is represented by Supervisor Leticia Perez. At issue is an east-west split in county demographics and politics. The county had wanted to preserve two separate districts serving Eastern Sierra residents, split between the northern half of the county and the southern half of the county. In its suit, MALDEF said that split essentially resulted in disenfranchising Latino voters in San Joaquin Valley communities like Delano and McFarland. MALDEF won that suit, setting off a chain reaction of events that could redraw district lines in Kern County, even ahead of this year's elections. The next step is a hearing today, federal court in Fresno before U.S. District Court Judge Dale Drozd, where both sides will present their arguments about remedies. Yesterday afternoon, I had a chance to speak with MALDEF staff attorney Tanya Pellegrini. Tanya, from your perspective and that of your group, why is it important for Latino voters in northern Kern County communities like Delano and McFarland to be in the same supervisorial district as those further south?
So it goes back to the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965. The federal government, Congress, Supreme Court have recognized the importance of voting rights, and they've also recognized how seemingly benign voting mechanisms can result in the dilution of minority voting power. And so in Kern County, for example, we know that there is a community of interest between these Latino communities. It has to do with agriculture, with, environmental concerns, different political concerns. And so in Kern County, there's this shared community amongst these Latinos that they have been split up for so long, and they deserve to be in the same district so that their voting will not be diluted.
When it comes to actually drawing lines, there is some art, there's some science to it. I know your group has drawn its own lines as proposals. The county drew its own lines. That's how this wound up in court. Tell me a little more about how that is done.
So every year there's the decennial redistricting. And in this case in particular, in 2011, when the Kern County Board of Supervisors was drawing the districts, Latino residents from Kern County and also representative from MALDEF put the board on notice that there was a possibility to have two majority Latino districts where the majority of those voters are Latino. And the Kern County Board of Supervisors decided to implement a map that did not have those two majority districts. And part of that process is public input. And so the public input asking to have the two districts was not taken into consideration.
Going back to the residents in these different communities, the Kern County Board of Supervisors and county officials had wanted to preserve the option of having two different districts for those living in eastern Kern County, north and south. What you're saying is that essentially voters in Arvin and voters in Delano have more in common with each other. Is that a correct characterization?
I think it is correct to say that they have more in common than voters in Delano have with voters in Ridgecrest.
How significant is it that this case actually came to trial and your side prevailed here? It's relatively rare, at least in recent history, for a California county to be involved in this sort of a suit and to lose it. Does this have precedent in recent history?
Yeah, so why it's rare here in California is that California has the California Voting Rights Act. And so we as a state, we've recognized the importance of having equitable elections. And so because of that, there's been not as many federal Voting Rights Acts, but you know, they are very hard to prove. They're very time consuming and they're very expensive. And so that's why, you know, these cases are harder to bring under federal law. And the California Voting Rights Act makes it easier for plaintiffs to bring cases. Unfortunately, here, the California Voting Rights Act does not provide a remedy because it's only for at-large elections, and the Kern County Board of Supervisors are elected by district. And so that is why we had to proceed under the Federal Voting Rights Act.
This could, at least looking at the proposed maps and things that came out during the trial, could result in a Latino majority district. Of course, that doesn't mean that a Latino candidate would necessarily win that seat on the Board of Supervisors, but why would this be significant just on those grounds?
Well, it's significant because the Voting Rights Act protects voters. And so we've seen vote dilution of the Latino community in Kern County for a very long time. And when you have districts that are drawn more equitable, and when we see the majority Latino districts, there may not be overnight a shift where we see Latino candidates elected, but we will see Latino preferred candidates elected. And that's really what the voting right is intended to protect. That's the voters. And so it will give voters in Kern County that are Latino the ability to elect the candidates of their choice, something that they've been deprived of for many years now.
So walk us through what's happening next, both on the legal side, we'll deal with that first, and then get into how you would like to see this actually implemented. What's the status of the case right now? As you got this judgment a little over a week and a half ago, where are we right now in the court process?
Okay, so after liability has been found in Section 2 cases, the next step is to give the county a chance at drawing maps that comply with the Voting Rights Act. If the county is unable or unwilling to do so, then the court will then implement maps that do comply. Right now, we have a status conference set for March 6th, and at that time, we will learn what kind of schedule that the court will put forward in terms of implementing a remedy.
We have an election coming up. This is an election issue. Supervisorial seats are up. How does this play into the elections that are upcoming?
So we will urge the court to implement districts that comply with the Voting Rights Act for the 2018 election. There's a couple ways that could happen. It could either be that the court can modify the schedule for the June primary and have the election in June have the new maps that comply with the Voting Rights Act. Or the court has the ability to suspend the Board of Supervisors elections for June and say that it will proceed in November under the new maps. And then there's different options that could follow there that the court could do. But we are going to urge the court that it should be done for 2018.
At what point does it become too late to implement something in time for that June primary?
You know, it depends. District courts have found, different timelines are not enough time or are plenty of time. Usually when they find that it's too late is when the election process has happened. What I mean by that is that the vote by mail ballots have gone out. The election, you know, is just a couple weeks away. At this time, there's still time to be able to implement districts that would comply.
Is the public going to have a chance to weigh in on any new proposed district boundaries, or is this going to be something decided entirely under the purview of the court?
So generally under Section 2, it is something that's decided under the purview of the court. But, you know, voters can always go to the Board of Supervisors hearings and express their concerns and, you know, let the board know what they would like to be done.
Again, we've been talking today with attorney Tanya Pellegrini. She's with the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, which just won a major court suit against Kern County, challenging the county's approval of district lines for supervisorial districts that they say excluded Latinos from exercising their voting rights under the Voting Rights Act. It could result in a second Latino majority district on the Board of Supervisors. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and talk with Mark Borzowski of the Fresno Bee about a potential solution to a management problem with public lands on the San Joaquin River. That and a look at the architecture of Julia Morgan. She didn't just design Hearst Castle. She also designed some buildings in Fresno. We'll talk about that in a moment. Straight ahead. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For years, Fresno officials have been in an odd spot. The state purchased hundreds of acres of undeveloped land on the San Joaquin River just on the edge of the city. The land is destined to be a public park, essentially. It would bring much-needed green space to a city that is near the bottom of national rankings for park access, and it would fill a big missing link in the San Joaquin River Parkway. The problem, though, has been getting access and finding the money to operate and maintain the property. In recent months, the first problem appears to be resolved, and now a Valley lawmaker has an idea on fixing the second one. Here to tell us more is the Fresno Bee's Mark Borzowski, who's recently written about this. Mark, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Joe. Good to be here.
So we're talking about the River Parkway, land on the river bottom of the San Joaquin River, just north of the boundary of the city of Fresno. River West specifically is about 500 acres of that land that's owned by the state. So the state owns it. What's the deal? Why is the public not there already, or at least officially?
Well, I mean, River West has been a difficult puzzle, kind of a labyrinth. I mean, that was land that was purchased for $10 million by the state and Packard Foundation back in 2003. And we went, 14 years without, it's still sitting out there without any official public access. You know, last fall and winter, we had a little movement. The San Joaquin River Conservancy Board, they finally announced a plan to at least access that area. It was very controversial about where that access road would be from. The board chose a road, probably the more expensive option, and to me it wasn't the best one, but it still was an option that would get people down to the river from the vicinity of Palm and Knees Avenues behind Spano Park.
So we can get access now, but that's only part of the problem.
That's only part of the problem because it's kind of the weakness of the conservancy model of assembling a parkway is that there's bond money used to buy up all these parcels of land from willing sellers. And this is along the 22-mile stretch of river from Fryant Dam to Highway 99. There's also other public lands contained in there. Some of it's owned by Fresno County at Lost Lake Park. Some of it's owned by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Some of it's even owned by the Fresno County Office of Education. But forming all those things into one contiguous parkway has been an issue. And then the other issue is operations and maintenance. All this money that's been spent to acquire these parcels of land can't be used, to put a picnic bench on there or a bathroom or ranger patrols or cleaning up, you know, trash, collecting fees. Those are the kind of, that money just, it can't be used for those purposes. So that's been kind of the issue that's been plaguing the Parkway for a while. Will continue to plague River West until we figure out a solution for that.
So Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula of Fresno now has floated a new idea in the legislature that would involve the state getting even more involved. How would that work?
Well, I mean, the Arambula's bill, which was introduced in the state assembly about a week and a half ago, it would basically essentially extend the boundaries of Millerton Lake State Recreation Area to include the entire envisioned 22-mile parkway all the way to Highway 99. And again, it's not a contiguous piece of land that we own, but the state park would still have, I guess, authority or be over those parcels of land under the terms of the bill. And that would provide, he estimates, to be about $5 to $7 million for operations and maintenance for different parkway lands, including River West.
Now, the state parks system has its own problems, but I understand, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I understand that looking at the state parks map, there's a big gap, relatively speaking, at least when it comes to recreation type parks in this part of the state.
Oh, yeah, certainly. We're, you know, Millerton Lake is the only state recreation area. It kind of borders Fresno and Madera counties, you know, on the San Joaquin River, obviously. It's amazing to me how many people around here don't realize that Millerton Lake is the San Joaquin River. It's just part of the whole mystery of the river here. But then Kings County, Tulare County, there aren't any state recreation areas there. There are a couple state parks. There's Colonel Allensworth State Park is in southern Tulare County. There's a small little state park, or they call it State Historic Park, outside Oakhurst. But again, those aren't, you know, those are nice places and good to have them there, but they're not places to go hiking, camping, fishing, and the like. And really the closest one other than that is San Luis Reservoir, you know, outside on the west side of the valley, and some of the grasslands complex a little north of there.
So what are the potential drawbacks here? I assume even though the state would have jurisdiction here, funding wouldn't necessarily be assured. The state park system has, in recent years, gone through a lot of turmoil. A parks director was released after a secret slush fund was found
Sacramento,
and many parks a few years ago were shut down statewide because of a budget crunch. Would this guarantee the money needed to operate this?
Yeah, about guarantee. That might be a little strong word, but it definitely provides a framework for that money. But of course, you know, in addition to the, you know, the problems you alluded to, you know, then all of a sudden our parkway is kind of at the whims of Sacramento. And if there's a bad budget year and state parks funding gets cut, then in fact that could hurt us. And also, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I frequent Millerton Lake State Park. It's not, they don't have the, you know, the people I think who work there, they mean well and they want to do a good job managing and running the park, but I don't think they're given the resources to really do so. I mean, all you have to do is drive to the South Feingold picnic area, you know, on any weekend, which is the start of the San Joaquin River Trail that ends up all the way in the San Joaquin River Gorge outside Auberry. And that picnic area is routinely closed. You won't see it open. You know, there's other facilities that I think they're underutilized. So no, it's not a great, perfect solution, but it could be something to give us a hand, because right now, in my view, the parkway, we're kind of floundering a little bit to make this happen.
So what's been the reaction since the bill came out and since your column came out? Have you heard specifically first from anybody at City Hall, because they're the sort of 500-pound gorilla in the room?
Well, I don't think City Hall is, I don't know if they have a big issue as far as the state parks taking over. The City Hall is really concerned with the parks that are contiguous to Fresno, which River West is the main one. But there's a lot of lands that are outside of the city limits that really wouldn't have anything to do with the city. That's the problem with this parkway, is that we have a city, we have two counties, and all these private entities, not to mention gravel mining companies. Everybody has a little stake or a little property along the river. So getting everybody to row the boat in the same way has been a problem. You know, there are some people, I've talked to some people at the Parkway Trust, the nonprofit Parkway Trust, which I think a lot of people, when they think about the Parkway, they think about the Parkway Trust. And some of those people think, yeah, it's a good idea, it'll help us. And then some of those people don't really want the state meddling around in the Parkway. But again, you know, I always come back to, well, what kind of a Parkway do we have now? We're not doing such a great job on our own of building this Parkway. So maybe this can help a little bit. And I'm not going to stop pushing until I can ride my bike all the way from Frye Dam to Highway 99 on a contiguous recreation trail, just like the folks in Sacramento can do, just like the folks in Bakersfield can do, all over Los Angeles and Orange counties and in the Bay Area. I mean, you go to Reno now, soon you'll be able to ride your bike from Reno all the way to the summit, you know, Donner Pass. The trail doesn't go that far now, but it's made a lot of progress in kind of alarmingly little time compared to our Parkway, which kind of seems to be stuck in park, is the term that I use.
Before we go, we have just a few minutes left. There's a lot of other sports news. You cover sports, the intersection of business and sports and government in Fresno right now. The Fresno FC Football Club debuts in just a little over a week from now. You have the new owners of the Fresno Grizzlies, and you also have talk about potential future for hockey in Fresno. Is Fresno undergoing a little bit of a sports business moment right now?
It is a little bit. That's you could frame all those under one umbrella. They're kind of different teams, but I know, like, Fresno, I think, has been ripe for professional soccer. I've been kind of pushing that since 2015 after seeing the large crowds that come out for the Liga MX Mexican Pro League games at Chuck Chancey Park, and also the relatively robust attendance for the Fresno Fuego, which is a name people are familiar with, but I don't think most people realize that's an amateur team consisting mostly of college kids on their summer vacations. Fresno FC is a whole different ballgame. That is a professional team. They have a payroll. You know, they maintain the payroll themselves. I believe it's somewhere in $500,000 to $600,000 range. And these are Fresno's players. Although there's an affiliation with the MLS team, the highest level of soccer, the Vancouver Whitecaps are the parent club. They can't call people up and down like the Fresno Grizzlies happens to them with the Astros and before that the Giants. These are Fresno's players. So, you know, and the Fresno FC is paying these players to play here. So
what's different this time? We've heard over the past two decades, 25 years, we've heard a number of business groups come to town, say that they're going to do this with sports. We're going to bring arena football, or we're going to do and a variety of different incarnations of the Grizzlies, AAA. What makes this FC
different? Well, I think soccer
FC
is a
different?
Growing sport, first of all, and there's untapped demographics here in the Valley, right? Fresno State hasn't had a soccer team in, you know, a number of years, probably going more than two decades, and it's just a growing sport, and I think the health of the league is different too, Joe. This USL, 5 years ago, the expansion fee to get a team was $250,000. The owners of Fresno FC had to put up $5 million expansion fee. So that can tell you about the health of the league and how much it's growing. So right now, they're playing at Chuck Chancey Park, which has been widened. They've done the general manager over there, Frank Yallop, he was really concerned about how do I turn a baseball stadium and give it a soccer feel to make the soccer purists happy. And we'll never really completely do that at a baseball stadium, but I think he's done a great job of kind of aligning the field, making it wider than ever before, pushing it closer to the majority of the seats. I guess in this case would be the first baseline. And, you know, whereas the Fuego didn't have the money to remove the pitching mound and to cover up, resod the infield every time they took the field, that's not going to be a problem with Fresno FC. You go out there now, it looks like a soccer field. And when the Grizzlies play and there's overlap there, there's going to have to be a transformation going on with the field.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, any potential tension between those two clubs and how...
I don't think there's potential tension. You know, the Grizzlies are the primary operators of Chuck Chancey Park during the baseball season. And the new ownership group, which I also had a strong first impression of, you know, they were the ones who worked out the deal with Fresno FC to use the stadium. So because that's kind of their role in the stadium. And, you know, everything I've heard is that went really well. And, you know, the new managing general partner of the Grizzlies told me implicitly that we don't view Fresno FC as competitors. You know, we view them as partners. So although they do overlap seasons, you know, I think I'm not so sure the fan bases completely overlap. It might be different people going there, you know, but maybe not. You know, we'll see.
We'll see how it plays out. A lot of exciting news. Mark Warzowski of the Fresno Bee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Joe. Anytime.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 4 years ago, Julia Morgan became the first woman to win the prestigious gold medal from the American Institute of Architects. It was a landmark achievement for the native Californian. It's the Institute's highest honor, and one shared by icons of the industry like Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, and Frank Gehry. Even more remarkable, Morgan was awarded the honor 57 years after her death. The award was an attempt in part to correct a long-standing omission by the male-dominated AIA. But while Morgan died over 60 years ago now, you can still see her legacy today in Fresno. Here to tell us more is local historian and historic preservationist, Karana Hattersley-Drayton. Karana, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I want to talk about Morgan's work here in Fresno, but her work here is not quite as large or as famous as another building she designed in Central California, this little thing called La Cuesta Encantada. Uh-huh. Many people may know about her castle. Tell us about that building.
Okay, San Simeon. You know, I have to say that's not my favorite work of hers. Perhaps if I went back and looked at it again, I'd feel differently. But Randolph Hearst, she built it for the Hearst family, for Randolph Hearst, had a huge role in it. And he was quite the patron, and it's sort of, gosh, I hope this doesn't sound terrible, it's kind of a mishmash between Chinatown and Spanish, you know, revival. But the interiors are gorgeous. Of course, she didn't do all the interior work. But what is really significant about that particular site is the Neptune Pool. She was trained as a civil engineer at Berkeley, and that was extremely unusual, you know, in the late 19th or early 20th century, and then worked with Bernard Maybeck. But she, because of that engineering background, was amazing at designing things under very difficult circumstances. So the Neptune Pool, which is gorgeous, is built over an earthquake fault. So that really stands out in my mind.
And a major restoration of that pool just completed.
Yes.
Recently at Hearst Castle. So stylistically, we think of Hearst Castle when we think of Julia Morgan, but that doesn't necessarily typify her style.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. But again, please understand, I don't feel I'm any kind of expert on Julia Morgan. I'm very much appreciate her. The thing about Julia Morgan, she was trained at the Ecole, the School of Arts in Paris, and that is, I don't know the date, they did start an architecture program. And this is long before the United States had architecture programs. And again, Berkeley at that time only had an engineering program, although Bernard Maybeck taught drawing. So that's how Julia Morgan began to get involved with architecture. And the Ecole was very rigorous on classicism, really taught through, you know, the Atelier program, a variety of styles, and taught the students to design from the inside out, which is kind of interesting. So that's the way she continued to work with clients. And did she have a style per se? No. She was expert at a number of styles, but she was always thinking about the climate, the location. So the buildings she did here, were they the arts and craftsy? Well, one of them may have been. Look that she had in the Bay Area, you know, with shingles and redwood and blah, 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 blah. No, they were much more Mediterranean because this is much drier climate. She worked with the clients and she worked with the location and she worked in a variety of styles, but definitely in the Bay Area arts and crafts.
So a pioneer of California architecture, period. Mm-hmm. A pioneer for women in architecture also, though.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, she was, I think we could say, the leading architect and maybe the first woman architect. I would hate to get challenged on that, but she was the architect for the YWCA, for the West Coast. And so she designed so many Ys along the West Coast and even Hawaii, you know, Honolulu, I've been to that one, Pasadena, Berkeley, Oakland, etc. And she designed two Y buildings here in Fresno. And that's our connection, which is kind of cool.
Now, both are still extant. One does not resemble its original form at all.
No.
And we'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about the one that people can see today and really get a feel for what made Julia Morgan special, the residence hall from
right.
1921 on M Street, downtown Fresno.
Right. And you will often see 1922. In fact, I noticed in the a book done by her on Julia Morgan. They give a 1922 date, and I changed it to 21. And the reason for that is when I was doing some research on another property up the street, I ran into this wonderful article in 1921 or whatever in the Fresno Morning Republican. And it talked about Julia Morgan coming to Fresno. And she came here, she always had worked with the clients, like when a family, you know, they wanted a house, she'd sit on the floor, she'd talk to the kids, what do you want? In this case, it was the first time she really worked with the women who were going to be living in this residence hall. Now remember, 1920s is when women were leaving the farm or the little city, the little town, and coming to the big city of Fresno or Oakland or whatever. And they needed a safe place to live where they would be chaperoned and their virtue would be guarded, if you will. And so she came to Fresno, and this article talks about that. She sat down with women who were going to live there and said, well, what do you want? What do you want in your kitchen? How do you want this laid out? And she referred later to the fact that this was the most democratic of all her buildings.
Very interesting. Now, it's always a challenge talking about anything visual or even spatial on the radio, but give us an idea of what this building looks like.
Well, first of all, you can drive by it if you're listening. You can go to 1660 M Street, and there's actually several really interesting buildings in that part of Fresno. It's the very top of the old parent grid. And it is a Mediterranean-style Spanish Revival meets whatever, with certainly arts and crafts detailing. It's an H plan. It's symmetrical, which would be very classical in its presentation on the outside with a kind of a stepped back central portion. It's a concrete clad or stucco clad, I guess I should say. She was the first person to really work with concrete in homes, for example. That was when people were still building with wood. So she was very comfortable with either concrete buildings, you know, structurally, which this I don't believe is. I'm sure it's framed with a stucco clad. And, you know, with a courtyard. I've been there. I'm trying to remember. You know, the wings surround a courtyard. And one thing that's very arts and crafts, because remember the arts and crafts movement, it wasn't just about art or building. It was about a way of life. So she had on the backside a sleeping porch, which in the old days was open to the air. And that was not just for the comfort in the summer, and they were all over Fresno. My mother slept on a sleeping porch in Berkeley, and in Berkeley in the summer is not exactly hot. And part of it was the fresh air. And this was part of the whole aesthetic movement and the whole health movement that was part of the arts and crafts, again, from which Julia Morgan came.
So there was that building, which we can still see, designed in 1921 by Julia Morgan, famed architect. It's on M Street in downtown Fresno. That's one building that we can see today, the residence hall on M Street. Just down the street and up the block at Tuolumne and L Street stands another building mm-hmm. she designed a few years later as a recreation center for the YWCA. It was significantly remodeled in the 1960s, and in fact, it looks like a building from the 1960s
yes, it
today.
Does. Yes.
How common was that sort of practice? Did people realize what they had at the time, that this was something by a famed architect, Julia Morgan? Is that something that's commonplace that we see in the areas dealing with preserving historic buildings, or was it even considered historic to people
well,
at that time?
That's an excellent question. I mean, Julia Morgan had gone through a period where her work had fallen out of favor because she, in fact, as you probably know, she destroyed most of her drawings when she closed her office, in part because, you know, she felt like she was kind of out of sync with the international movement and whatever. So to answer your question specifically, I think, yes, that's probably too common. And in Fresno and many places, we've also demolished buildings that were historically important, architecturally significant. I mean, we could give many examples of that. So I think, yes, that building was redesigned, reclad, if you will, by Robert Stevens, is my understanding. And he was a great architect. Should he have messed with Julia Morgan? Who's to say?
Exactly. What do you think her legacy is today, now that we have the benefit of you know, almost 60 years after her death, over 60 years after her death, looking back at her work? Certainly Hearst Castle is so famous.
Yes.
But what is her legacy right now in 2018?
Well, she stands as a giantess among architects for the work that she did as a woman architect. But 700 buildings. She designed 700 buildings over her career and maybe even more. Her work was impeccable. And for the time, I mean, she was part of the whole sort of the second wave of the First Bay tradition. And these folks, she was the only Californian in that group. And they were very concerned, as with the arts and crafts movement I've already mentioned, in getting real materials, you know, local materials, meeting the climate and the specifics of the site. But she also hired impeccable craftsmen, you know, from Italy and whatever. And she kind of dragged these folks around with her for years. And so the quality of the workmanship is unparalleled. And I think maybe my favorite buildings of hers are her wood, you know, her arts and crafts buildings out of Berkeley, because of course I went to Berkeley, and they're beautiful. They're just absolutely beautiful.
Again, Julia Morgan, awarded the AIA Gold Medal 4 years ago, the first woman to ever win the prestigious award from the American Institute of Architects. It was awarded 57 years after her death, and you can see one of her buildings in Fresno on M Street, the YWCA Residence Hall. Karana Hattersley Drayton, local historian and preservationist. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There's a new exhibit on display now at the Coke Halliwell Center for River Studies on the San Joaquin River Parkway, dedicated to the works of famed local watercolorist Roland Pickford. The exhibit is available now through April 29th at the River Center. And joining us now is Roland's son, Joel Pickford, an accomplished artist himself as a photographer. Joel, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Your exhibit that is taking place at the Coke Halliwell Center features never-before-seen paintings by Roland Pickford. It seems like it would be impossible to have never before seen works of an artist of that caliber who was active for so many years here in the Valley up until his death a few years ago. How many never before seen paintings are there?
Well, not all of the pieces in this show are never before seen, but there are definitely some significant ones that haven't been seen. My dad was almost too prolific for his own good. And as a result, the body of work is voluminous. And after my dad passed away, when my mother and I were going through it, we actually discovered some wonderful paintings of downtown Fresno that nobody had ever seen. That certainly would have been good enough to make it into the book.
The book California Light.
Yes.
What do you mean when you use that term California Light, or what did the people who coined that phrase mean when applying that to your father's paintings?
Well, I think there's a special kind of light here in the Valley, and I think probably we called it California Light because my dad was known for painting the Central Coast as well as the Valley. So it would have sort of, if we call it Valley Light, it was sort of, you know, left the coast out.
What's special about that light, though?
It's a light that's really tempered by the seasons and by changing conditions of weather and so on. And my dad was able to capture that because water was kind of central to his paintings. Like, the most important thing he used wasn't a particular paint or a brush. It was water, which he often got right out of the landscape from puddles and so on. And what makes my dad different than most other watercolors is that he worked very, very wet. Most watercolorists work dry. That is to say, they'll put a layer down, let it dry, another layer, and it's very controlled, and it's very sort of hard edge. But my dad kind of rejected all that, and he loved the sort of unpredictability and serendipity of water, even though, of course, the paintings often failed. But so I think my dad found a connection between the light and weather conditions and the water itself. For example, if it was foggy, that the paper would stay just the right wetness to render fog. If it rained, he didn't run for shelter. He just let it rain right on the painting. And some of the paintings you see raindrops And so if it was sub-freezing on a particular morning, he would just let it crystallize and it would leave these beautiful little lacy patterns. So, I think that's, light sort of translates into water, and that's what my dad's work was all about.
So tell us a little about this exhibit thematically. It's curated by Michelle Ellis-Pracy of the Fresno Art Museum. And his works really capture in many ways part of the valley that is increasingly fading from memory, the small family fruit orchards that now have been largely paved over in much of Fresno and Clovis are some of the subject matter for this exhibit.
Yeah, and Michelle specifically asked me to give her some, folders of JPEG images of that kind of stuff to work with. She chose not to do any of the urban work or the coastal work or the more abstract and experimental work. She really wanted it to focus on valley landscapes. And in fact, there are a couple of pieces in the show that are very... that were painted very close to the Coke-Halliwell Center for River Studies itself. The title piece where you're up on the Fryant River Bluffs looking in and you see that little herd of cows and the casting the shadows. And then there's another piece of two cypress trees that my dad and his friend Tom Valiant used to paint over and over. And that painting was painted 65 years ago in... 1953, and the cypress trees today look exactly the same. As you drive out to the river center, keep your eye out to the left, look for two cypress trees, and you're going to see a painting of those done 65 years ago, and they seem not to have aged at all.
It's fascinating. Again, the exhibit is up at the Center for River Studies, the Coke-Halliwell Center, the old farmhouse that they restored down there on the river bottom by the River Parkway. It's on exhibit Saturdays and Sundays, 10 to 3, also by appointment during the week by calling the River Parkway. I also understand you're working on another project, archiving your dad's work and eventually donating it to the special collections at Fresno State, the Madden Library.
Yes, actually, we started a partnership in 2014 with the Madden Library, and with Special Collections. We're very excited about it. Since that time, we have been gifting our collection of work in annual installments, and we'll continue to do so probably another 20, 25 years until the gift is complete. But in addition to that, we're building a really rich historical archive. We've also given them all of my father's journals from a period of like 60 years. We gave him all of my father's publications, and I've digitized all these things so that when we're ready to launch, which will probably be next year, we'll have all of these things online so that the researchers that are interested in this stuff can do it. The paintings themselves, my dad was very... thorough about always recording the date and location of each painting, writing in the margins, and once in a while a framer would trim it out or something, but for the most part we have that data. So we're building it all into the database, and in addition they're going to put geotags for the location of each painting that was done. But the paintings really document a changing landscape here in the valley. I don't have to remind listeners that sprawl has eaten a lot of farmland up, and a lot of the farm property that my dad painted years and years through his long friendships with some of those small family farmers is now paved over with and red tile roofs and strip malls and so on. So that's one of the things that former library dean Peter McDonald was really excited about when we met about the possibility of us gifting the collection there.
Again, Joel Pickford joining us today talking about that new exhibit at the River Parkway of his father's watercolors. It's now through April 29th. Joel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Talk@kvpr.org is our email address, and find our podcast on the website as well, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Christina Lopez and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment, health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.